Good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The top stories: Iran's foreign minister says the positive developments in JCPOA revival talks in Vienna fall short of Tehran's expectations. Fresh anti-racism protests erupt in U.S. cities, sparked by the fatal police shooting of a young African-American in Minneapolis. Boris Johnson suffering another blow in his battle for survival, with one of his most loyal supporters saying the U.K. Prime Minister's removal is now inevitable. Our top story: Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a telephone conversation with European Union's foreign policy chief Josep Borrell. He says the 2015 deal has not had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits in a reliable and sustainable manner. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. In the latest developments, Washington has announced the restoration of a sanction waiver, but Iranian officials say the U.S. should show its goodwill in practice and by removing all its anti-Iran sanctions. Earlier, we reached out to history professor and political commentator David Yahubian to get his comments on these developments. He says the JCPOA would only revive if it benefits Iran economically.
Amir Abdullahian is, of course, stating and repeating the obvious, that it's only going to be verifiable and sustainable sanctions relief that brings Iran fully back into accordance with the JCPOA if it can be saved. And the State Department release is very specific. It says that this is not a quid pro quo, that this does not necessarily benefit Iran, but it explicitly says that even if the JCPOA is not returned to fully, if both sides don't return to full implementation, and I'm closely paraphrasing here, it will still assist us in our non-proliferation efforts. Therefore, this potentially benefits the United States if the JCPOA is not returned to. It does indeed facilitate the ultimate return to full implementation by both sides, and therefore, to Amir Abdullahian's point, it's still moving in the right direction. But no, indeed, this doesn't provide Iran with anything, and what Iran is looking for is verifiable, sustainable sanctions relief. Even a full year after Donald Trump pulled out in May of 2018, Iran maintained all of its commitments under the agreement, despite the fact that it never achieved the goal of the agreement for Iran in the first place, which was sanctions and relief. So thankfully, I think we're at a point where the Iranian negotiating team, quite seasoned and quite skilled regarding the various tricks and shenanigans, if you will, that the United States is going to try to pull off here, we're either going to return to a JCPOA that benefits Iran economically, or we will not be returning to the agreement.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says all regional problems and issues can be solved if foreign powers stop their interventions. In a phone call with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, the Iranian president said the problems in the region are due to the excessive demands of the United States. He added that if the Americans are literally expelled from West Asia, regional countries will fully establish peace, stability, and security by cooperating and with each other, that is. Raisi also said Iraq has a significant position in Iran's policy with regard to the development of neighborly and regional relations. Al-Kadhimi also welcomed Iran's approach in the comprehensive expansion of neighborly and regional interactions. He expressed hope for deeper bilateral ties and cooperation. Saudi warplanes carry out over 30 fresh airstrikes across Yemen. The provinces of Sana'a, Sa'ada, Jawf, and Hajjah have been the targets. There was no immediate word on the possible casualties. Saudi Arabia and its allies have ramped up their aggression against Yemen in recent weeks. The Yemeni army is responding with cross-border retaliatory strikes inside the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. It says it will continue its operations until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war comes to an end. The U.S. administration has changed hands between Democrats and Republicans since the outbreak of a Saudi-led war on Yemen in 2015. No matter which government holds the reins, the U.S. sticks to the same policies. 7 years on, the U.S. continues to provide the coalition states with unwavering military and diplomatic support, making itself complicit in Yemen's war crimes. In this report, we will review how three U.S. administrations missed their chances to end one of the world's bloodiest wars.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians, because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If they the United States will continue, or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Welcome back. Racial tensions heating up in the U.S. again, with hundreds of protesters turning out in Minneapolis to demand justice for a young African-American killed by police. Protesters demanded the dismissal and arrest of officers involved in the shooting. They also called for racial justice, denouncing police violence against black people. Similar protests were held in New York City. Amir Locke was shot dead after police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Police say they opened fire after Locke pointed a gun towards officers. But critics argue that Locke was never given the chance to disarm himself in the chaotic moments. An investigation is now going on. This is the latest incident to put police forces in Minneapolis under scrutiny. Almost 2 years ago, if you recall, a white police officer killed George Floyd, an unarmed black man, by leaning on his neck in that fashion for more than 9 minutes. Controversy around British Prime Minister Boris Johnson thickens as one of his most loyal backbench supporters says his removal is now inevitable. Former Tory lawmaker Sir Charles Walker has implored the Prime Minister to step down in the national interest. This comes as Johnson faces mounting pressure to resign over his handling of Downing Street's lockdown parties. The so-called Partygate scandal has caused several MPs to turn their backs on the Premier and prompted five senior number 10 aides to resign. Johnson could face a vote of no confidence in his leadership if 54 of his 360 Conservative lawmakers submit a letter of no confidence. So far, a dozen MPs have publicly turned on the Prime Minister and submitted such a letter. The U.S. is further fanning the flames of tensions in East Europe by deploying troops in the region. We discussed that matter with our guests in our news review program. Take a listen.
The United States is deploying additional troops to Europe as a standoff between the West and Russia intensifies over Ukraine. First batch of American soldiers landed in Poland shortly after the arrival of senior U.S. commanders. Polish Army spokesman says the bulk of a contingent of 1,700 U.S. soldiers will soon be coming. President Joe Biden is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania. Washington says the move is aimed at shielding Eastern Europe in the face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. U.S. and its allies have accused Russia of amassing over 100,000 troops along its border with Ukraine in preparation for an invasion. Moscow denies that and is strongly opposed to increased military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its borders. Joining us now is Mr. Mike Billington, from the Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, Virginia. Hope you're doing well, sir. Welcome. And your initial thoughts on the, okay, Russia wants just a few security guarantees, and this whole thing can go away. The U.S. and the West are not giving it, not even entertaining any of those security guarantees. Once again, we're seeing this my way or highway policy when it comes to an adversary by the West. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you're right. And the U.S. and the British and NATO continue their provocations, such as these troops. But the world changed dramatically yesterday when Putin and Xi Jinping issued a joint statement after their meeting in Beijing, which is literally the declaration of a new paradigm for mankind, not just for Russia and China, but for the world. And to understand how profound this statement was, the Daily Telegraph, which is perhaps the leading voice of the British Empire in the city of London, headlined an article today, I'll read it, "Russia and China rise from their knees to challenge U.S. dominance." It says, "The Russia and China are asserting the arrival of a new geopolitical era." I would actually add that this is an anti-geopolitical era. Geopolitics is the British imperial game of zero sum. And in fact, as you know, I'm sure, Russia and China are focused on this Chinese idea of win-win, of a common future for mankind. The freak out, and it is a freak out by the Daily Telegraph, goes on to say that these two nations, after decades of humiliation, have risen from their knees and will now upend the inequitable post-Cold War world order. Now, you might say this is good to hear some truth from the British for a change, but the fact is they're basically declaring that they can no longer hope to prevent Russia and China from collaborating and from collaborating on the development of the Third World through the Belt and Road. And the implication is that they have no choice but to go to war. That reality, I think you should know. Michael Bloomberg, one of the leading spokesmen for Wall Street and for the Green New Deal and the whole Malthusian genocide being imposed by the Western banking systems, yesterday posted a headline on Bloomberg News that said, "Russia invades Ukraine." This lie, this provocation in the midst of the hysteria that's been developed over these last months, daily reports that Russia's going to invade Ukraine imminently, even though Russia denies it, and in fact, even the Zelensky regime in Ukraine denies it, yet it continues day after day after day. And then Michael Bloomberg posts a headline saying, "Russia invades Ukraine." This is precisely what the Schiller Institute and the LaRouche organization have warned could lead the West into what could be sleepwalking into thermonuclear World War III. Mr. Peshkov, the spokesman for Putin, basically said the same thing.
It's always a pleasure, Mr. Mike Billington from Leesburg, Virginia. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
And that's it with international news.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon his word, and I cling only to his cord. In thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Islamic Revolution and Islamic Art. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. The art of the Islamic Revolution is a special kind of art which was shaped concurrent with the struggles of nationwide struggles in Iran against the despotic Pahlavi regime. The works of this art have tried to promote the Islamic and revolutionary thoughts more or less for over four decades. Thus, the art of the Islamic Revolution can be called a branch of the Islamic art. The Islamic art emerged in the 6th century AD. Later on, it was manifested in various geographical regions according to the features of those regions. Iran is among the countries in which Islam spread very rapidly. Owing to its cultural and artistic record, this country was effective in bolstering the Islamic culture and art. Yet, it should be mentioned that Islamic art is part and parcel of the Iranian identity, and this religion has been very effective in strengthening the Islamic civilization. ¶¶ Some researchers are of the opinion that the Islamic art is the art of conveying the divine concepts. Therefore, this art should be at the service of the Islamic teachings. In other words, the Islamic art should mirror the metaphysics and the spiritual aspects of life. As it has been several times, and it is quite obvious, the Islamic revolution was triumphed during the heyday of the anti-religion schools and ideologies like Marxism and liberalism. The Islamic revolution presented a new message and put forward a new way which showed the bond between human being and religion. Heeding the sublimity of mankind and paving the ground for growth of human merits shaped the main principles of the Islamic constructions. In view of this, the absurd thoughts and models like art for art's sake were pushed to the margin, as the Muslim artist always feels responsible before the people and above all God for what he or she creates. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, popular art was praised as the substitute for modernist art, which was an amalgamation of realism and expressionism, and ultimately had its roots in humanism and liberalism. Concurrent with distancing from foreign culture, strengthening the domestic one had good impact on Iran's art. Thus, the Iranian art was introduced in global arenas. For instance, the Iranian cinema was introduced with different themes and higher quality and quantity. The cinema was known as across the world as an example of cinema committed to ethics, human values, and the values of the Islam and Islamic revolution. The Islamic Revolution, like any other social, political, and cultural phenomena, had no choice for production and transmission of its ideals and values but to manifest them in artistic works. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Any thought and any revolution that is not shaped in the form of art will not survive." The revolutions of the 20th century had no ideal society of their own in history, and they were ultimately and mainly dependent on the beliefs and ideals which were affiliated to society. The Islamic Revolution, however, had focused on its past Islamic identity and tried to revive those ideals according to the requirements of the modern time. During the heat of the Islamic Revolution, a number of students of the faculties of art joined the ranks of people and founded the basis of a current which became known as Islamic Revolutionary Art. Later on, they held exhibitions in Tehran and other cities. With the start of the imposed eight-year war in 1980s, artists reacted to this great event in pursuit of two goals. Firstly, they tried to persuade people to join the war fronts and sympathize with the combatants. Secondly, artists wanted to symbolically demonstrate the highly lofty values and beliefs like martyrdom, which was manifested beautifully by the youth in battle fronts. Therefore, most of the artists would attend the fronts to directly narrate the unique scenes of valor and self-sacrifice of the combatants. In view of this, the walls of cities were painted with the pictures of martyrs who had heroically sacrificed their souls to safeguard the country and Islam. comparison of the arts during the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution shows that, in many cases, the elements and motifs of the ancient Iranian art are present in the artistic works of this era. The Iranian artist now looks at the Western art with more precision. He tries to reconstruct and update his ancient heritage with modern methods and moderate the teachings of the new art according to the ancient genuine values. A unique feature of the Islamic Revolution's art is endurance and continuity. Who is it so? Ayatollah Khamenei believes that the reason is the fact that the revolution speaks of truth, and truth stays firmly and strongly. The art of the Islamic Revolution, too, has continued and flourished as it speaks and depicts truth. The last but not the least, the Islamic Revolution has made artists committed to moral and human values. The Iranian artist has realized his responsibility before mankind and has become depictor and illustrator of justice, love, self-sacrifice, martyrdom, and all human values.
We here at RIB English Radio congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
When international tennis star Novak Djokovic was denied entry to Australia and detained in Melbourne's Park Hotel, a migrant detention center, there was a silver lining for the refugees held alongside him. These are men who came to Australia seeking asylum, seeking refuge, many of them just boys at the time. But now, almost a decade later, they have languished in various detention centers, some of them up to 9 years. Australia's practice of sending refugees who arrive by boat to offshore detention centers has been compared to Guantanamo Bay, where Australia wants all the power but none of the responsibility. Forcibly transferring refugees to nearby Papua New Guinea or the island nation of Nauru and keeping them in horrific conditions, people are beginning to ask themselves, why is Australia treating these men like criminals? And is it meeting its obligations under international law and abiding by the Refugee Convention? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. International tennis star Novak Djokovic was slated to compete in the Australian Open tournament. Non-citizens must be vaccinated in order to enter Australia. However, Djokovic was given an exemption from mandatory COVID-19 vaccination. Once the Serbian tennis player arrived on Australian soil on January 5th, he was denied entry and his visa revoked. The Australian government suddenly changed its mind, claiming that Djokovic didn't meet the country's entry requirements and that his presence would encourage anti-vax sentiment in the country. Djokovic was taken and held at Park Hotel in Melbourne. Now you might be thinking, well, what's so bad about being in the Park Hotel? But this isn't just any ordinary establishment. This particular Park Hotel is used as a migrant detention center by the Australian government, where refugees and asylum seekers are sent and kept there for years in some cases. People began showing up outside the hotel in solidarity in support of Djokovic, seemingly unaware of what else was going on inside the building. Djokovic's lawyers went to court to dispute the Australian government's decision to revoke his visa, and there was a public hearing, a live stream of it, which attracted around 80,000 viewers on YouTube. And now, while Djokovic was allowed to leave the Park Hotel after just a few days, the refugees weren't. Many of these men came to Australia as teenagers, seeking asylum, fleeing war, and are now men, having been locked up in detention ever since. Currently, there are around 33 men who are held in the facility. They were transferred to the Park Hotel from other offshore detention centers in places like Nauru and Papua New Guinea for medical treatment. However, in late 2021, the place essentially became an incubator and was nicknamed Outbreak Hotel because of the unsanitary conditions which caused COVID to spread rapidly. At least half the refugees in the hotel caught the virus. The conditions in Melbourne's Park Hotel are quite horrendous. One of the refugees there, Muhammad Joy Mia, posted a picture of the food that the refugees have been given containing mold and maggots. The refugees are not allowed to leave the hotel. They cannot even open their windows for fresh air, as these have been sealed shut. All they have is air conditioning. Now, as we said, they were transferred from offshore detention centers. Many of these refugees have been in detention, shuffled around facilities for years. An Iraqi asylum seeker, Salah Mustafa, has spent 8 years in detention. Another refugee, Thanush Selvarasa from Sri Lanka, was first detained in 2013 on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea for 6 years, and then in the prison Hotel Mantra in Melbourne for another year. He was finally released in January 2021. Today, Thanush Selvarasa is a human rights activist for people seeking asylum and an ASRC, Asylum Seeker Resource Center, human rights intern. He joins me now from Australia. Thanush, thank you so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, brother. I appreciate that.
And I'm very grateful. Could you maybe tell us how you came to Australia and how you came to be in detention?
I came to Australia 2013 by boat for seeking asylum and safety. Unfortunately, I reached Australia after 19 July. They make the policy that law is if anyone come to Australia after 19 July, they transfer to offshore processing center. They will never ever settle in Australia. This is a policy they've made. But I wouldn't know about that. My friends also know about that policy. Unfortunately, we transferred to the offshore processing center. It's very difficult. I couldn't imagine how was this being in offshore processing center.
Which facilities were you in? Because you said you were first in offshore detention. Where was this exactly? Which facility? And when you were transferred by Medevac to Australia, where did they send you then?
Yeah, I was 6.5 years in detention offshore processing center. Then I transferred to Australia to under the Medevac law. Then I spent my year, 1.5 years. So totally I have spent my lifetime in detention for no reason, 8 years.
I'm very sorry to hear that. That's very heartbreaking. What were the conditions like? How were you treated in detention? You know, how was it living inside of this kind of prison, not even knowing when you will be released?
This is a story about they transfer to offshore processing center if anyone come to Australia by boat. Then, unfortunately, my and my friends transferred to offshore processing center. It look like island, like a prison island. Like it's everything out of our control. We can't do anything. Lack of medical facilities, and day by day deny our freedom in there, and our day by day we were destroyed mentally and physically. It's very difficult to explain the feeling of what inside the indefinitely detention. That's why 13 of my friends were lost their life on that island because of mental health issue and medical issue. That's why after that, we were lost 13 innocent people life. And then finally, in Australia, they passed the law. If anyone affected with this sick, they can transfer to Australia under the Medibank law. That's a law they passed. Then in that law, some of my friends were moved to Australia from Officer Processing Center under the Medibank law.
And how did it impact your mental and your physical health?
Very quite pain, but we were separate from our family long term years, but they called by number day by day, and we waiting for the phone call to talk our family for 1 week one time. The internet also is an offshore processing center. It's very difficult. It's a different type of punishment to us. I can't explain the feeling how much difficult to being in there in different detention. This is a punishment like without bleeding, cut our neck. This is I don't know how to explain that feeling. And really, very hard and pain.
So they put you in this this hotel detention center, and the windows are sealed shut. You can't open them for fresh air, and you're not allowed to go outside and get any sunlight. That's it? That these are the conditions that they put you in?
Yeah. This is a condition I was in there, but it's a very difficult. We can't open the window. We can't get the fresh air. We can't get the sunlight. It's a, I don't know, brother. This is a pain we have. Some of my friends still having that pain. Now people understand very well how difficult to be in quarantine for 14 days or 7 days.
And how did you get out of detention? Can you maybe tell us about the moment when you found out that you're finally free? How did you feel?
Really, I couldn't realize that I'm going to be free. But before then, 1 week, my group of people were released from detention. Before then, me, they were released. But that is a day we were. That is a long term year. After 8 years later, I'm going to pass the message to my mother. Just I waiting for the one message to tell them my mother for 8 years. Hello, my mom. I am free. I have been waiting for 8 years to tell that message. Not only me, for my other friend as well. It's a long term year. But when I called to my mom, she was speechless. I couldn't imagine how was she happy in that moment. It's a very incredible. And on that day, I called by my name with my friends. It's a very, very wonderful moment on that time. When I going to release from detention, some of my friends waving the hand on the street, welcoming us. It's such a wonderful moment. It was still on that memory. Never ever gone from my mind.
Yeah. And what was it like outside of detention? Can you tell us maybe about what kind of visa or permit that you've been given, and what are some of the challenges or the difficulties that you face with it? Are you able to work and live normally?
We got the temporary visa. This kind of visa, we have the rights to work, but we don't have a right to study, or we can't fly overseas. This is a visa. This is a very big challenge, brother, because we have to renew the visa each 6 months one time. If we're going to apply for any job or company, they will expect the long-term visa holder. They don't want anyone to short-term period visa holder to work there like employee. But this is a situation we have facing day by day. And in my experience, last time I trying to get the house for rent under my name, but the two or three landowner, they reject my application because I'm on temporary visa. But it's a very difficult. Especially we were a detention center last 8 years. We don't have any economical background. But at the same time, we're trying to rebuild our life into the community. It's very, very difficult to rebuild our life without any economic support, because we can't get the credit from bank, because we don't have the permanent solution, or we don't have the visa.
How were you treated by the staff, the people who are working in the detention centers?
Some of them, they treated like rudely. Some of them treated nicely. But first time is I talked to some of officers in there. I asked some help, and they did us. But after that, long-term in detention, but I don't like to talk to the much to the officers, but in there that working like guards. But I don't like to talk to them, because I have a pain. But each time I hate them, to why you keep the into the detention with no reason. They don't understand our feeling. They look like they see us like we have done something in previously or something like that. But they don't know about our story, why we came to Australia, why we have been in detention, internal detention for no reason. But they look like us, different view, but they don't know. But I did not talk much to the guards in there.
So they looked at you like you were criminals or something? Or
in my experience, when I was in detention center, I got an appointment from doctor for the medical treatment. They take to me the hospital with guards and with the handcuff. But in front of public, they locked me with the handcuff to take to the hospital. It's anyone see me, they think oh, this guy have done something. But on that moment, tears fall from my eyes without my permission. But I denied to go to our hospital to get treatment with handcuffs.
Tanush, what is your message to Australians? What is your message to the world? How can people help?
This is my message. If every innocent human has the rights to be free and enjoy their life, no one should have their life put called indefinite detention for no reason. My friends have been in indefinite detention for no reason. They have to be free into the community. It going to be must end. But this is the way people need to push the MP or send the letter and make the signatures and push the government to release my friends, for they have been in long term in detention for no reason.
Well, Tanush, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences, and thank you so much. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much, brother. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Australia has been heavily criticized, both at home and abroad, because of how it treats refugees and asylum seekers. In 2014, the Tony Abbott-led government launched a campaign aimed at deterring refugees from coming to Australia. Its slogan read, "No way, they will not make Australia home." As the poster says, people who travel to Australia by boat without a visa will not end up in Australia. They will be sent for processing in Nauru or Papua New Guinea. Australia's policy is that anyone who comes by boat will be sent to these offshore detention centers. If you enter Australia without a visa, you'll be detained for an indefinite period of time. Australia basically operates offshore detention centers in these countries, such as the infamous migrant detention center in Nauru, a camp that has been compared to Guantanamo Bay. I mean, just look at the map. Look how far away it is from Australia. It's over 4,000 kilometers. It's literally in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific Ocean. And Australia basically wants to send these people off to someplace else and shirk responsibility. So instead of helping refugees and asylum seekers who are fleeing, it punishes them by sending them to a remote island in the middle of the ocean. How is this any different from a penal colony? And now, while the number of detainees has fluctuated and diminished since 2014, and some people have been resettled in Australia or the US, there are still over 100 asylum seekers on Nauru. People who've worked at the migrant detention center in Nauru have described it as a prison. A school teacher said that there are guards at all times everywhere, and that children aren't referred to by their names, but with numbers. Each child has to identify themselves with 3 digits and 3 letters. The staff who work there work on rotation. They're told that they shouldn't stay there for more than 3 weeks at a time because it's bad for their mental health. They have to leave the island and take breaks. Well, hold on a second. If it's bad for the staff to stay on Nauru for 3 weeks, for more than 3 weeks, how is it okay for the refugees to stay there for years and years? What does it do to their psychological well-being? What does it do to their mental health? The Australian government said that it wanted to crack down on people smugglers, people who take money in order to smuggle refugees and asylum seekers, bring them to Australia, so it could stop them from making money and exploiting people who are seeking asylum. However, an investigation revealed that the Australian government was paying these smugglers to not bring migrants and refugees and asylum seekers to Australia. So clearly, the Australian government doesn't mind the smugglers making money when it's paying them off. Now, it's important, of course, to talk about Australia's obligation to help refugees under international law, within the framework of international law. Australia is a signatory to the 1951 Convention relating to the status of refugees, meaning Australia is responsible for those who seek refuge or protection from its government. However, on numerous occasions, the United Nations has found Australia to be severely lacking in providing for those who seek its help. A report by the UNHCR on Australia's practice of forcibly transferring refugees to Nauru or Papua New Guinea says that, quote, the majority of asylum seekers transferred from Papua New Guinea and Nauru to Australia have still not had their claims for international protection determined after more than 4 years. François Crépeau, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants, decried the conditions on Nauru as, quote, cruel, inhumane, and degrading. The Torture Convention prohibits subjecting people to cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment. In 2015, the UN found that Australia was in violation of this, quote, by leaving people locked up indefinitely in appalling conditions on a remote island, Australia is failing to meet this basic standard. Then Australian PM Tony Abbott responded to the report by saying that he thought Australians are, quote, sick of being lectured to by the United Nations. Now, another myth that is commonly perpetuated is the notion that refugees must claim asylum in the first safe country that they reach. This is completely, absolutely untrue. It's false. That's not a law. That's not a requirement under international law. The Refugee Convention says absolutely nothing about this. And not to mention that many of the countries that refugees pass through to get to Australia are not even signatories of the Refugee Convention, or they simply lack the infrastructure to resettle refugees. Now, when it comes to these offshore detention centers, like in Nauru, it actually costs more money to send refugees to Nauru or Papua New Guinea than to rehome them in Australia. The UNHCR report reads that Australia's National Audit Office confirms that holding refugees and asylum seekers in offshore processing facilities costs approximately 15 times more than allowing them to live in community detention in Australia. An article from The Guardian, published on January 23rd, 2022, says that the Nauru offshore regime will cost Australian taxpayers, quote, nearly $220 million over the next 6 months. $220 million just to hold 107 people. The company that oversees the camp is Construct International. It's received $1.8 billion in the last 5 years alone. The article continues, quote, it currently costs Australian taxpayers more than $4 million a year to hold one person within the Nauru offshore regime. That means a little over $11,000 per person per day. When the Australians talk about their borders and enforcing these strict rules, did they just happen to forget that Australia is a colonial project of the British Empire? When the Australians say, no way, the refugees will not make Australia home. What about themselves? All these Europeans and Brits who came to colonize Australia and make it home. Do Australia's natives, the Aborigines, do they get a say in who they want to take in on their land? Or is it just the white British and European colonizers who get a say? What a lovely double standard, isn't it? You know, they say they don't want refugees. Well, who's creating these refugees? Didn't Australia invade Afghanistan? Isn't Australia involved in American military operations which destabilize these countries? Doesn't Australia accommodate U.S. imperialism by hosting American bases like the one at Pine Gap and now this new alliance with AUKUS? The Australians invade Afghanistan, violate Afghanistan's sovereignty, kill Afghans, destroy their homes, occupy their land for 20 years, and then have the gall to say, oh no, you can't come to our place. This is what's so disgusting about this rhetoric, not just from the Australians, but from the Americans, the British, and other Europeans. They complain about refugees on their shores, and they complain about Muslims and Arabs and Afghans invading them, but they don't mind invading Afghanistan, invading Iraq, invading Syria, bombing Somalia. Where do they think these refugees come from? They think people risk drowning in the Mediterranean or off the coast of Australia for fun? If NATO hadn't destroyed Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and all these countries, there wouldn't be a refugee crisis. If the British and the other European colonial powers hadn't invaded, enslaved, and plundered Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East for centuries and centuries, you wouldn't have such an imbalance in wealth and development. Why do you think we have developed countries and developing countries? How did we get to a situation where there's such an imbalance between the two? It's precisely because the European colonial powers stole resources and plundered the rest of the planet and enriched themselves. These Western countries invade, kill, steal from others, and then complain about refugees showing up from the countries they destroyed to enjoy some of the wealth that was taken from them. It is such a sickening, vile hypocrisy. It absolutely beggars belief that people cannot see this injustice. People will one day look back on how the West created these refugees and how it treated them, and future generations will find it revolting. Now, Djokovic, he's an international tennis star. He has fame. He has media attention. And he was able to get out after just a few days. But the refugees who are still locked up in the same Park Hotel as Djokovic was in, they're not as lucky. They need help. And they need people to raise awareness on their behalf. And so do those who are still locked up in these offshore detention centers. They need people to fight for them. They're not criminals. They shouldn't be in detention indefinitely for the crime of seeking asylum, for the crime of trying to find a better life, for the crime of fleeing imperialism, war, and unimaginable horrors. It is their right under international law to seek asylum, and we must never forget that. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The EU's latest financial gift rewards and encourages the Zionist regime's criminal behavior. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Ali Abunima, journalist. This article is published under the heading EU Using Green Deal Funds to Power Israeli Settlements. Stay tuned for more. Last week, the European Union announced over $1 billion in funding for Green Deal projects, supposedly aimed at facilitating a clean energy transition. But the largest chunk of the cash, about $700 million, will directly benefit the Israeli regime, including its colonies built on occupied Palestinian land. The European Union claims to oppose those settlements, regularly acknowledging that they are built in violation of international law. The new money will go towards constructing the Eurasia interconnector, an underwater cable that will tie the Zionist regime's electricity grid to Europe's. According to the project's website, the Eurasia interconnector will function as an energy bridge, allowing for the transmission of electricity between the Eastern Mediterranean and Europe. The project has had high-level EU support ever since the leaders of Greece, Cyprus, and the Israeli regime signed a June 2017 agreement setting it in motion. Brussels says the latest cash injection following an earlier approximately $100 million in EU funding is a continuation of the financial and political support of the Eurasia project. The EU gave its full backing to the electricity link, even though it has always been clear that it would mean connecting the Zionist regime's colonial settlements to Europe and potentially supplying them with power. This would connect